Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's Friday, and it's Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis, filling in for Dave Schrader. All right, I'm going to pull the curtain away from Oz. Truth in advertising. I'm going to shoot straight with you guys. So I'm talking to Dave on Messenger. You know, he's over in England right now. I don't know what he's doing over there. Probably trying on the Queen's jewels, for all I know. And I say to him, you know, hey, I got the Gary Busey episode coming up, and I moved it to Friday because, you know, I wanted to do the Elvis commemorative episode on Thursday. And he goes, Gary Busey? Nah, wasn't a good episode. And I went, what? Because I listened to it, and I had edited it, and you know what? It sounded pretty good to me. I thought it was entertaining. I thought it had some decent stories and even some out there theories. And he went, no. Find something else. So guys, here's the conundrum. I got something else for you today. But if you'd like to hear Gary Busey, here's what I got going for you. Here's what I'll do. And I'll do it just for you folks. Because Dave claims I don't love you. It's not that I don't love you. I don't love you as much as he does. I still love you a little bit. Here's what I'll do. If... and only if I receive enough emails, I won't say what the number is, but if I receive enough, if there's enough of a groundswell to hear the Gary Busey episode again, I will include it and tag it on the end of one of the episodes next week, because it's kind of a shorter interview with Gary. If not, no harm, no foul. We'll revisit it sometime in the future. No big deal. We just won't be in a rush to do it. How does that sound? Does that sound okay to you? It sounds okay to me. Today, however, we've got a couple of very great guests, and we're going to explore a couple of different things. How does a little Trinity theory and the code of creation sound in the first hour? We're going to talk with Marie D. Jones and get the theory from the time that this was recorded about using creation and your ability to use creation and the power of God. Kind of cool, huh? In the second hour, we're talking to Peter Robbins, and Peter Robbins is an expert on the Rendlesham Forest. And I figured I would dig this out because, of course, if you've been paying attention to Dave's social media, he was at Rendlesham Forest this week, and I just want to creep him out on the flight home because that's kind of bastard I am. So we, as in there's more than one of me, but I dug up the episode of Peter Robbins in Rendlesham Forest and some truly creepy tales about Rendlesham Forest, just to kind of cap off the week. So without further ado, here's Marie D. Jones up first on Beyond the Darkness.
Good evening and welcome. This is Darkness Radio, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, Mally Fox, Tim Dennis. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, exploring the strange and unusual world around us. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Evening.
We've got an old friend joining the show again tonight, Tim.
Yes.
I know she's been on with us quite a few. I don't think, well, yeah, maybe has she been on with us since you've been a part of the show, Mally? Maybe the 11-11 time prompt phenomena?
Yes.
Was that one of the shows you were here for?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got our good friend Marie D. Jones is joining us this evening, and we're going to be talking about her new book. Marie, thanks a lot for joining us and coming back this evening.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you back with us. Tell us about the new book. The title is?
It is called The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. It's a little bit different.
Nice short title again, right? She's always got the best titles, like 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomena, The Meaning Behind Mysterious Signs, Sequences, and Synchronicities.
Well,
rolls off the tongue.
I learned why our subtitles always have to be long, and that's the keywords.
Right, exactly. So as people are trying to Google you.
But you know what? Nothing is worse than science. I mean, that had the longest subtitle in the history of books. So I think we're getting better. We're like cutting out a word with each book.
That is good. Yes. You're wrapping it up. And we've had you on for, geez, I think quite a few of the books. The science book, which was one of the first ones we had you on for.
Yeah, it's 2000,
yeah, 2013. We've had you on for the 1111 time prompt phenomena. And now you've got a brand new book, and it's out, and it's co-authored with Larry Flaxman again, correct?
Yes.
All right. Well, start to give us some background on this, Marie. We've talked about the 1111 time prompt phenomena. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, before we get into that, I do want to ask you, you know, it's interesting. We've had so many people that have pounded us with emails after listening to that show in the archives. But this is an interesting year, Marie, and we just did a show on numerology about this a few weeks back, that in this year, if you take the last two numbers of your birth year,
right,
and how old you're going to be this year, and add them together, you start getting 11s, series of 1s and 11s.
Right.
Numerology talks about the fact that 1s and 11s are very powerful, strong numbers dealing with gateways. It's such an interesting little deal. Have you seen a resurgence of interest in your book because of this kind of phenomena?
Well, that and the fact that we're getting closer to 2012. And
we are?
11-11. We're going to make it. We're going to hang on, guys.
Oh, God.
You know, the 11-11 time prompt comes from that whole scenario, the fact that at 11:11 a.m. on December 21st, the winter solstice will begin. And that's according to the Naval Observatory's atomic clock, where they can get everything down to the precise moment. So whatever, you know, asteroid is going to hit us and supervolcano is going to erupt and aliens are going to land, it's all going to happen in that one moment of 11:11. But it's just a really interesting series of numbers that people see all the time.
Mally, does that frighten you that you're going to be stuck in a radio station with Tim and I the minute Armageddon hits? We're the last two guys.
I mean, come on.
Well, with these lead-lined walls, it may be up to us to repopulate the Earth, Marie.
That sounds like a horror story.
Wait a minute. Hey.
Marie, will you fly to Minnesota and be with me at the end?
I will. You know, I have a private jet ready for the night before to take me wherever I want to go.
Wow. Aww. A private jet.
So yeah, I guess Minnesota will be my destiny.
Right on.
How sad for you, Marie Jones.
Exactly. Minnesota.
I was thinking Tahiti, but hey, what the heck?
Yeah, Tahiti, Minnesota.
She can come
it's
here and pick
thing.
Me up, leave you guys behind,
oh,
and
I
we'll
see.
Go to Tahiti.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Marie, it's hotter here than it is in Tahiti, girl. Just remember that.
Yeah, but Tahiti has the Tahitian boys. See,
wow.
Different.
Oh. Well, that is true. Tim, I would blow you off for a Tahitian boy.
Really?
And I'm straight. I'm sorry.
All right,
that's just
then.
The way I play. The Trinity Secret is the book that we're talking with Marie about tonight. And I promise we're going to get to the book, Marie. The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. Now, are we talking about the Holy Trinity? What are we delving into in this book?
We're talking about that. In the beginning,
okay.
What happened was when we were writing 11:11, you know, we really got into the whole number thing.
And right.
The one number that really kept popping up more so than ones or 11s is 3. And I had many, many years before written a thesis paper for a ministerial class that I was taking at the time. This was a long time ago. And it was a very formal paper on Trinity symbolism, because at the time I had found it in everything, every religion, you know, all the different world mythologies, in folklore, fairy tales, human language, science, you name it.
Sure.
But it was a real formal paper. It was not for publication. So when Larry and I were kind of, okay, you know, what do we feel like working on next? We just kept thinking about the fact that number 3, you know, what is it with number 3? And I was talking to a lot of numerologists and a lot of people that are into sacred geometry, and you name it. And everybody kept saying, yeah, you know, number 3 is a very profound number. So the book kind of grew out of that. The Holy Trinity is a symbol that is found everywhere. It's not owned, quote-unquote, by Catholicism, as a lot of people think it is. And it's actually got very ancient, almost pagan roots. So we were just really fascinated that the more we looked into the origin of the Trinity, the more we found it everywhere.
Isn't it interesting, not meaning to go back on this, but kind of tying it into your 11-11 time prom phenomena, when we were talking at the beginning of the show here about how if you take the last 2 years of your birth year and the year, or you know, how old you're going to be this year, any of those of us in our double digits will all end up with 111. Numerology, you add those together and you come up with?
3, exactly.
Now, that being a transitional number, I mean, is there something to this that's cueing us into what's coming for the coming age? I mean, 2013, I'm getting a little tired of banging the drum on that. I don't believe that the end of the world is coming, as they're saying.
Not at all.
But, but it's a new opening and a new rebirth. Is that what you find with the number 3 and with the Trinity here?
Yeah, and here's my take on it. I do not believe the world is going to end. There's absolutely no scientific basis. There's no religious basis. There isn't even a basis for that in the Mayan mythology. That is stuff that was added on to the Mayan creation stories and their mythology by Western religious traditions, this whole idea of an apocalypse. However, they did believe in cycles. And that when one cycle ends, another one begins, and we are coming up on even the astrologers, the age of Aquarius, the Hindus believe we're moving into another yuga, another cycle. The Native Americans all feel like we're coming at the end of one cycle. So we really have to pay attention to that part of the picture. Okay, so one cycle is ending and another one is beginning. And so if you want to describe that as the end of the world as we know it and the beginning of a new world, you can, but I don't think it was meant to be taken literally. We're not all going to die. If we haven't all died before, I don't think it's going to happen now. And it just seems like people are getting ready for a different kind of transformation rather than a physical one. It might be something that's happening with technology, with our brains, with our DNA, or just consciousness. I think a lot of us are really being pushed to the limit with how much we can deal with lately. So we're either going to have to adapt or die, in a sense, and maybe this is the time to do it.
All right. You heard that, Mally. Adapt or die.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a little harsh. But we're going to have to change, or we're going to go back, we're going to really suffer for it. I mean, I think if we keep going the way we have been, we're going to start suffering for it.
Now, are you religious in nature, Marie?
Oh, hell no.
Okay.
That's my kind of girl.
Good, yeah. So you're not religious in nature. So researching a book like this, you can remain on the objective and on the outside looking
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, I'm a fallen Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic.
Now, here's the deal. I grew up in a family where we went to church when grandparents were around.
Oh, so you were Christian, or you were a Christmas and Easter Christian. So.
Exactly.
Okay,
my
sure.
My dad's a scientist. I grew up in a house that was, my mom is, really imaginative, spiritual person, and my dad is a scientist. So religion was just something that we did to not have our grandparents yell at us. But
okay.
But the thing is that I loved it. I loved the ritual. I loved the symbolism most of all. I really was hooked into that when I was very young. Why do they use all these really cool symbols? The cross and this and that. And so I really started studying. I minored in world religion in college because I was fascinated with the commonalities. It's like, we have all these religions, they're all saying the same thing, and yet we're all killing each other over the differences instead of focusing on the commonalities. So I have a real interest in religion, but I also don't have a whole lot of respect for organized religion, let's put it that way.
All right, well then doing the research for this book and working into it, let's start with the most famous of the Trinities that people think of is the Holy Trinity, the Father, yeah. Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, what does that mean to you in relation to the research that you did for your book?
Well, we looked at the history of what the symbol has meant to Christians and the Catholic Church. The difficulty with the Trinity is that for, a long time now, well mm-hmm. over 1,000 years, there's been a whole lot of confusion as to really what the Trinity was describing. We grew up as Catholics believing that the Trinity described the face of God, the persona of God. But there was always argument, well, how could God be the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit? Where does Jesus fit in, and what the hell is the Holy Spirit to begin with? I mean, nobody seemed to know. The funny thing is that when you go back and you look at how the Trinity symbolism shows up in other religions, how it shows up in paganism and ancient Greek and Roman philosophies, you start to see that they're talking about a process, not a person. And it is the process of creation. So when you look at the Trinity now in this new way, it makes sense. The problem is organized religion cannot tell you that you have access to this same process of creation because that takes out the middleman.
Okay, well, explain this to us now, Marie. Mm-hmm. So you're saying we have access to the process of creation.
We absolutely do.
To what level? I mean, I'm a father of seven children. I know I've got the process of creation down pat.
Yeah, you do, boy. Woo-hoo.
Right, but what are you referring to in creation? I mean, to create our own reality, to create our own worlds, to become gods of our own mind?
I think in a sense, but we haven't quite gotten there. Looking at the original Trinity, we've got the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father is the creator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we can kind of all get that. We can hook on to that. The Father is God, the creator, however you want to call that God. To me, it's like the force, you know, the field, whatever you want to call it.
The force, yes.
The force, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Son aspect, again, in Christianity and Catholicism, Jesus represented the Son as the physical manifestation of God on the earth. So the Son is the creation. So you've got the Creator, you've got the creation, Father and Son. The one in the middle is the Holy Spirit. That is the act of creation. You cannot have something out of nothing without some type of action. And the interesting thing is many other religions refer to the Holy Spirit as the breath of life, the activating agent, you know, the spirit.
So for those of our visually in need listeners, to paint the picture, is this basically the Father is Dr. Frankenstein?
It could be.
The Son is Frankenstein, and lifting him up for that lightning bolt is the Holy Spirit. It's that moment of impact. It's that spark.
There is an act of creation that has to take place to get something out of nothing. So you can have a creator, and I think this happens on two levels. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it happened on the level that got us here on Earth. So there's some big creator out there, whatever you want to call it, intelligent design, I don't care. Label it the way you want, but there is a creator that made the cosmos, which is the physical manifest creation. There's also the actions that had to be taken for that to happen. If you want to bring it down to an individual level, we are God the Father. We are the creators. Our physical reality, our day-to-day life, is the manifest creation, and the active creation are the thoughts, intentions, and actions that we take on a daily basis. And most of them, unfortunately, are subconscious. You know, this is the law of attraction. That's really all this secret is. It's the same thing as what Rhonda Byrne is teaching with The Secret, what has been taught for thousands of years. That if you want to manifest something out of nothing, you need to do something. There needs to be an action.
Well, and Marie, with the paranormal investigations that we do, and I want to veer into this to get your weighing in on this. You know, there was the very famous Philip experiment. And are you familiar with that?
Is that the one where they created the ghost?
Right.
Yeah.
There's the stories that Jackie, the little girl ghost at the Queen Mary, is a non-existent ghost. She's not a real thing. There was no child that died aboard. There was no child that died. But it has been willed into existence because of people's belief and seeing it. Now, does that mean that we have in fact created this energy as because of all the people feeding into it and seeking it?
I think it's possible, and I think it's possible we're doing it collectively, and I think it's possible we do it individually. And again, I don't think we're always aware that we're doing it, which is why there's so much violence and BS in the world. I always say to people, if you want to know whether the law of attraction works for everyone. If you want to know how well it's worked for you, just look at your life. You know, you have somehow created everything. Whether you've done it willingly or not, subconsciously or not, that's your problem. But it does work. The job that you're in, the vocation you have, the spouse that you're with, those are all things that you wanted to create that you didn't have at one point. So you wanted to take something out of nothing, and you had to take certain action steps in order to do that.
Well, and for people, Marie, I don't know if you've seen this experiment, but it's one of the most impactful experiments I've ever seen, and I've used it at a few of our events to show people how we can change perspective and we can change energy of other people simply with thought. And that's, and this is an amazing experiment. Try this at home tomorrow, or if you're at work and you're listening to this, shame on you instead of working, but thank you for tuning in. Ask one of the big guys, get a group of your friends together and ask one of the big guys or strong ladies in your office to stand there and put her arms out like she's hanging on the cross.
Oh, yeah.
Put your hands on the wrists and push down and tell her to fight it, and you'll see how hard it is.
Right.
Then you tell somebody to come up and not speak a word, but tell them, for the next 30 seconds, 45 seconds, I want you to think the most hateful things about this person you can ever think. And then they do that. They just look at each other, and the one person just focuses all this negativity, and then you go back up, have that person put their arms back up, and watch how you can just pin the arms right down to their side.
Exactly. Energy is, I mean, we're learning through science that energy and even thought.
Right, thought. And that's
our physical manifestations. And, you know, if we don't learn now how to control that, it's going to control us. And one of my favorite books.
Well, let me mention one thing just so I can wrap up with this so that people can see the third part of the experiment. The last part of the experiment, you tell the whole group to stare at this person and think the most hateful, hurtful things. Now, if you figure to one person and reduce this person to rubble,
right.
You whisper into the person's ear and you tell them, for the next 45 seconds, all I want you to do is focus on how great you are. Think of every good aspect you have. And then after you've got this whole room of people focused on one person, thinking the most hateful, horrible things about them, that person puts his arms back up. You can't budge them again.
Right.
Because it's their own beliefs have influenced their energy. And it is such an amazing deal to see the way that our energy can interact and influence each other.
Absolutely. One of the best books, and I'm sure you've read it, is Power Versus Force, Dr. David Hawkins, where he talks about doing that with lying, you know, having people tell the truth and, you know, they're able to maintain their power, and having them lie. And the whole kinesthetic experimentation really shows you how the body is linked into thought and how thought has energy to control the body. You know, why do we not get this? And it's the power of the human mind. And so with the Trinity concept, all of that falls into that middle realm of the Holy Spirit that for so long has tripped people up. What is it? It is when we want to create reality in our personal lives or even collectively as humanity, you know, this is what we think, believe, intend, perceive on a daily basis, and it accumulates, and the accumulation is our life. I mean, you know, being in the paranormal field, the vast majority of things people see comes from their individual perception, not necessarily from something that's actually there.
Right. Right. And it's even the thought and the perception of what they thought can actually influence other people to claim that they then saw the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah, Larry's done some experiments where he's planted ideas, planted things like, you know, starting out with a group of people that have no clue that they're in a location that is supposed to be haunted, and just planting ideas. Okay, on the fourth floor, a little girl died, and you might hear her calling out to her mom, saying, "Mommy, Mommy, I miss you." And, you know, I'll be darned, 90% of the people by the end of that night will claim that on the fourth floor they heard the voice of a little girl saying just that. And I always, when people play EVP, it drives me nuts when they say, okay, this next EVP, you're going to hear a male voice saying, "Johnny, come here," because the mind will latch onto that and hear it, whether it's on that tape or not. And I actually have, you know, done that with myself. If somebody leads you or suggests that you're going to see something in a haunted location, you're going to hear something on an EVP, your mind kicks into overdrive in order to really make that happen. And it just goes to show you how powerful our minds are.
Wow, that's very impressive. And when putting that together and seeing how we can influence each other. And I think that's then where the mass hysteria comes from, right? How that trickle down effect and watching one person interact. And if you don't believe it, folks, you ever walked into a room after somebody's had a fight and they may not even be in that room anymore, and you walk into that thick pea soup wall that's left there, and how that affects and bogs you down, or even psychic vampires.
Exactly.
Those people that you meet that within 5 minutes of talking to them, you feel completely drained and you just want to be anywhere but talking to this person.
Right. They're emotional drains.
Right.
And for some reason, because emotion and thought and all that stuff is invisible, we just cannot admit that it's real. You know, I mean, we are a prove it to me society. So what we can't see, we just sort of sweep under the rug. But we know this is happening. I mean, people have subjective experiences all the time, especially in the paranormal. And you can't really brush millions of experiences under the rug. Something's
right.
going on. But that doesn't always mean that there is a physical entity in the room or an alien or what have you. Sometimes I believe we are creating it out of a desire to, out of fear, out of expectation, because somebody told us that's what we're going to see.
Right. We're setting ourselves up for these experiences to occur.
Yeah, and it makes it really hard for real paranormal research because it's like, okay, well, now you got to take that next step to sort of weed out what is coming through personal perception and what might actually be there physically. And sometimes the lines are really finely defined, you know.
How do we do that? I mean, how do you differentiate that?
Well, I have no clue.
Well, thank you, Marie D. Jones, our guest this evening.
Good night.
You know, I mean, you know, like what Larry's trying to do where you're planting ideas and you're trying to do these different psychological experiments. That's great because they tend to work all the time. But there will still be opportunities when something will happen that goes completely against that. And it's just that dang repeatability factor. I think we're dealing with stuff that is so inconsistent and erratic, and some of that is because of us. I mean, we as the observers and participants are not consistent. Who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, we will have such controls over our own minds that we will be able to come up with some really good, solid experimentation that can be repeated over and over and over again. But for now, I don't know how you, without getting some real valid physical evidence that people can put their hands on, I don't know how you delineate between something that was created between a group of people with very powerful emotions and thoughts and something that was there before they even walked into the location.
Right. And then you run into the fact, though, that the question then begs itself, or did you begin to create this thought? Did this start to happen because there was something already there?
Yeah, it's really tough.
Well, it is, it's the egg or the chicken.
Right. Well, now we know the chicken came first. I don't know if you saw that news story.
I did not.
They actually showed genetically that there would have had to have been a... Yeah, I'll send you the link. It was just a few days ago that there would have to have been a chicken first.
Baloney.
So that whole thing, you know... But I know what you mean. It's like I always say, how do you prove... Is a haunted house haunted if there is nobody there to observe the haunting? You know, we go back to the quantum level and the idea that the observer effect can really change the outcome of an experiment at the quantum level. Well, what if that's happening on the bigger, grander scale? Does there have to be an observer, whether it's a human or a camera, in order for something to manifest, to be observed? Or is this stuff just going on all the time?
Our guest this evening, Marie D. Jones, she's a co-author of The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. Marie D. Jones and Larry Flaxman are the authors of that book. Marie, what's your website people can check out?
Our website together is paraexplorers.com, and that's P-A-R-A, paraexplorers.
Paraexplorers.com, and then do you have a website for yourself as well?
I do, but it's not up right now. I am having, it got hijacked.
Oh.
I know, it's so lousy, but
people are goofy.
I'm hoping in about a week to have it all straightened out. And
okay,
that's usually my website is mariedjones.com.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the book. We'll be back with more of the best in paranormal talk radio right after this.
Come and knock on our door.
Good God. Welcome back to the show.
I love it.
Hers and his. Three's company, too. Hey, welcome back to the show. This is.
I kind of figured that you're...
Put it down. I can't even hear you.
Okay, sorry. I kind of figured that you're Jack, I'm Janet, and Mally's Chrissy.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I'm even more disturbed by you now than I've ever been in my life.
I've always felt like a dowdy brunette who maybe couldn't get a date. Maybe it's just me.
We are talking about the power of three. The power of three being Mally, Tim, and myself. Obviously, Janet, Chrissy, and me, your buddy Jack,
Does
Dave, Schrader, Tripper.
Does that mean I don't have a brain?
Well, Anyway, our guest is Marie D. Jones, and she is the co-author, along with Larry Flaxman, of The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. Be thankful, though, that you've got thighs.
Oh,
and yeah, you're a master of
thighs. I'm the master of them.
You are the master of thighs. And
work it, girl.
Marie is here to talk to us. Let's get back on the serious track. We'll try. She's written quite a few different books that you can get involved. The Resonance Key, Exploring the Links Between. Oh, good God, you've got a long title on all of these. It's going to take me forever just to read the titles for you. The Resonance Key, Exploring the Links Between Vibration, Consciousness, and Zero Point Grid. We've also talked to her about Science, PSIENCE, correct?
Yep.
All right. And I don't want to get into all the super long titles on each one of her books, but she's got some phenomenal books. The 1111 Time Prompt Phenomena, and people love that book. Like I said, we've had so many people contact us after listening to that podcast replay, and they're inundated with the 1111 Time Prompt. Tonight, we're talking about her new number book, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. The book is out and available right now, and you can get it through all major booksellers. Amazon.com has them, and I'm looking at them right now. You can get them on special with free super saving shipping for only $10.87 if you go purchase it from Amazon. You're saving, what, about $6 if you go buy it there?
Yep, and I'll come to your house and cook you breakfast. Well, no.
Wow.
Really?
Well, maybe she'll come to your house, Tim. I don't think so, though. But
I'll take you to IHOP.
Oh, that's nice. So do you kind of explore numerology in this book as well? And
yeah. I mean, you can't help it if you're talking about numbers. So we get into numerology, and number three is obviously a very profound sacred number. It's sacred to the Masons. It's sacred to the Greeks and the Romans. And there's a reason for it. You know, one is just not good enough for people. We don't like the number one. One is the loneliest number, of course.
Oh, that is, I've heard the song.
But
two can be as bad as one, but it's the loneliest number since the number one, I've been told.
Absolutely, number one. But two is duality. Two is opposites. We don't like that. That makes us nervous. Day, night, black, white, you know, Republican, Democrat. We don't like dualities. Three is the perfect number because it unifies dualities. And beyond that, you really don't have to be concerned. So for a lot of philosophies and religions, three is the unifier. It's sort of the number of completion and wholeness. And the really cool thing that Larry and I found is, you know, we couldn't figure out why the heck is it that in folklore and fairy tales, everything comes in threes. You know, why are there three little pigs? And why are there three bears and three blind mice and three billy goats and three wishes, blah, blah, blah. And there really is a reason. It's called the rule of three. Ta-da.
Wow, that works out well for your book.
It really did.
So what is the rule of three? I've never heard of this.
Yeah, it's really cool because it governs a lot of human language. And you'll hear it a lot in politics and speeches, the way that words that are grouped into threes or chants or anything, really.
You mean like Obama's, yes, we can.
Exactly.
And yes, about, we can.
Yes, we can. But think about, my favorite is George Bush Sr. He did it twice. Read my lips, no new taxes. And he did that for a reason. Because if he said, okay, I'd like you to read my lips, I really am going to try to promise not to raise your taxes, that has no impact.
Right.
When you hear, and like, you know, it's like, I came, I saw, I conquered. Veni, vidi, vici. And this rule of three, what it does is it's a progression towards perfection. You start at the bottom with something that's powerful, but what it does is it leads up to the most powerful. So I came, I saw, I conquered. You know, conquered being the most powerful aspect.
Or, of course, there is the very famous statement, c'est la vie, c'est la guerre, c'est la pomme de terre. That is life, that is war, that's a potato. All right, maybe that didn't work as well as yours. But, okay, so the rule of three, actually.
I like that, though.
You like that? The rule of three does, you know, I think about this, and this is going to be, I'm totally outing myself as a man here, but you notice what attracts men. You walk by certain shops, and it says girls, girls, girls.
Girls. Location, location, location.
And what is the
X, X.
Yeah, what is the best rating for a good movie? XXX.
XXX. We totally glom onto three, and we do it subconsciously. And again, it's because you see it once, you know, X-rated, big deal.
Right.
You know?
Listen to Marie.
Oh, that's cool. But three, come on, you know. And it's just like with that real estate location, big deal. Location, location. It just doesn't have the same impact until you add that third word. And with the fairy tales, you know, you start with the weak little pig or the little baby bear or the little billy goat. And as you know, notice, there's a progression towards the most powerful, the smartest, the strongest, the most resilient, the most resourceful. Hmm. So there is a progression from beginning, middle, and end, just like we have in our movies and novels, the three-act structure. We see it in speeches, fairy tales, and because we respond to it. And one of the reasons why we respond to it is because of the Trinity. We respond to getting something out of nothing and going through that progression whereby you do that. You know, if you read a fairy tale, they have very powerful endings, and they're meant to really impart life lessons, even though you think, okay, three billy goats, big deal. But when you get to the end of that and the troll is sent up the river, you know, there's a real sense of satisfaction. There was a challenge. A lot of fairy tales include three different challenges that have to be overcome or three obstacles. When you get to that final one, it's like, I did it. You know, there's this real sense of satisfaction and completion.
Wow, I hate the fact that I've been learning all these times I've been reading these books. They're tricking me.
I mean, some of them
stupid
are really
fairy tales.
Scary. Jeez. I mean, they're really not for kids.
Right.
I really don't think they are for kids.
Well, the original fairy tales, hence the name Grimm Brothers, right?
Oh, they were horrible.
Are the nursery rhymes.
Yeah.
Horrible. That's why they're all remaking them now as movies for adults.
Yes.
Which is, I think, kind of cool. They're going to do Hansel and Gretel, the witch hunters, you know, as them as adults going out and hunting and killing the witches. It's interesting. I mean, really, fairy tales are very frightening.
Now, Marie, tell me, because I know my listeners are going to listen to this podcast, and at about 11:41 into the podcast, they're going to hear a weird noise behind you.
Oh, that was my son.
Okay, good. So it wasn't a ghost coughing over the line or a demonic trying to growl at us.
I should have said it was.
Okay. Right? Yeah, much better story.
No, that was my son.
All right, good. I'd just like to address that up front so I don't have to take 30 emails from people and explain what it is.
Oh, yeah. How did Marie talk and cough at the same time?
Exactly. That's creepy. Wow. I didn't even see her lips move.
Ventriloquist.
Yes.
That's my next book. I am leaving writing and all of this behind to study ventriloquism. I'm going to learn how to throw my voice.
Well done. That's well-placed money right there.
It is.
Okay. We're gonna take another quick break. We'll come back and have our final segment with Marie D. Jones. And again, the full title of the book, get ready for this, folks, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. This is the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio 3. So that's one by you. Two, and if we add them together, we
They're
come up with
three.
Oh, Lord.
We're good at math. Woo-hoo.
That is scary. All right. Well, we're back with our guest, Marie D. Jones, and her new book, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three and the Code of Creation. Now let's start getting into some of the meat. We've only got about 15 minutes left with you here, Marie, and I want to really start sinking into the people what the book is about, how they can use this book, what it imparts onto them. So give me the idea of why you said that you started to do this when you were working on the 11:11 time prompt phenomena and how threes kept showing up so prominently.
Right, right. I mean, it really began as another exploration for us. You know, researching something that we were intrigued by. But Larry and I had talked for a long time about really wanting to try to write not just information, but stuff that can really be helpful to people. We're both fascinated with the law of attraction, the idea that the observer effect, can we create reality? We're doing a lot of research into that. I've got a new book coming out that I'll tell you about that gets a lot more heavily into that. And so what we did is we took this book, we put a lot of technical stuff in it. But in the end, we gave it a real practical side. You know, how can we use our thoughts, our intentions, our beliefs to get what we want out of life instead of always using them to get what we don't want? So we're really, really proud and excited that this book, it kind of has a little bit of a self-help aspect, and it is selling like crazy, which we really thought this book was going to be difficult for people. You know, they weren't going to know what to do with it, but we're really surprised at the reception that it's getting. It's a little controversial for some people, but I think in the end, people understand that all religions, everything, science, mythology, it's all trying to tell us the same knowledge. just with different languages.
Well, and yeah, you think about other, you know, we were talking about the pop culture side of things with entertainment and how politicians use things in threes and right. the, you know, and like I said, you know, one of the funny things when we do investigations, Marie, is the three is the magic number. At 3 a.m., that's when all hell breaks loose. There seems to be a power about that. And for God's sakes, if we happen to hear, that's the demons knocking to get in.
Yeah, how come nobody knocks twice?
Well, that's what I said. When I always have to tell people that it's not a demon. It's just we all do that. We all knock.
Orlando and Dawn. Oh, God, I'm aging myself here.
Now, according to an episode of Paranormal State, the reason a demon knocks three times is to mock the Trinity.
Right, but if you think about us, I've told this, every human, when you go knock on the door, how does just about everybody knock?
Yeah.
It's three short raps.
I don't. I keep knocking until my knuckles bleed.
I just use the doorbell.
But do you ring three times now? Probably not, huh? That's obnoxious.
No, but she does walk around the carpet three times before she'll lay down. It's the weirdest thing.
There you go.
Like a dog.
Wow, thank you for pointing that out, Melly.
Oh, my God, that's funny.
You never tell the magician's secret.
No. Yeah, there you go.
Let's talk a little bit about Newton's three laws of motion, then. What else does that tie into?
Well, you know, it's funny. We looked at everything. We looked at the three laws of motion, the laws of thermodynamics. We looked at the structure of DNA, the structure of the human brain, which has three parts, the three levels of consciousness and psychology. Probably the most fascinating thing to Larry and I was the scientific quantum association with the number three. And this ties into the paranormal. It ties into everything. We are big fans of David Bohm. I mean, he's one of our favorite physicists. David Bohm had a...
Are you a physicist groupie?
I am, kind of, yeah. Yeah. They don't tend to be the hottest looking guys, but...
Rock that genome! Rock it!
Let's do this. You know, if we could take Rafael Nadal and give him David Bohm's brain... Oh, there you go.
And mix him with David Bowie, he'd even be better.
He'd play tennis three times as well, wouldn't he? All right. But anyway, Bohm talked about three orders of reality. There was the manifest, the physical, the explicate order. That's what we see all around us. That's the sun aspect of the Holy Trinity. There was the super implicate order, which was sort of the overseer, the supervisor, the godlike creative order. And then there was the middle one, the implicate, hidden, invisible, where all of the actions took place. And what's interesting with the paranormal is that when we talk about things that we don't understand, ghosts and entities and aliens and demons, we don't know where the heck these things are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
We have some data, some, you know, circumstantial evidence, I don't like to say evidence, that there are these things that are manifesting in our physical reality from somewhere else, whether that's parallel universes, alternate dimensions. But it could very well be that they're coming from this middle implicate order of reality. It is hidden. It's connected to everything else. But we only see the physical manifestations. We don't see the cause. We see the effects. And that's one of the things that we've been emphasizing with people in the paranormal is that, you know, we've got a lot of effects. We have a lot of data. We have tons of EVP and video and pictures. We got to start thinking about where the causes are coming from. And if they're coming from this implicate level, that's where we need to find equipment. I mean, how do you come up with equipment that can test things on the invisible level of reality? That takes a lot of theorizing.
That or a lot of really good weed.
It really, you know what? And that's actually not as funny as it sounds because... You know, experiments with LSD and DMT, I mean, you name it. Graham Hancock writes a lot about opening that part of the mind using hallucinogenic drugs or what have you, opium, peyote.
And by doing that, they're opening the third eye.
They are, absolutely.
Another three? Coincidence?
Ask yourself, is that where all the paranormal stuff is coming from?
Right.
Is it coming from inside us, or is it just that we're suddenly able to see it? When the third eye is open.
And isn't a nickel bag three fingers deep? I don't know. I'm asking Marie, because we take our drugs seriously in the paranormal field, don't we?
Do you?
She says.
I don't do those kinds of things, Tim. So, I'm pure as a driven snow.
I don't believe that, because 2 seconds ago you lit up when I mentioned weed.
Oh, stop.
Is that what the coughing was earlier?
Yes.
I lit up. Okay, there you go. No pun intended.
Yes. when you're doing this type of work, Marie, do you go into it with, okay, here you're talking about the power of creation. Do you go into it with a preconceived notion that this is already going on? And did that make it easier for you to find?
No.
Or were
actually,
you surprised by how many links came together like this?
Yeah. This, you know, Larry and I, our next book is on time travel. Now, we will go into that book with a lot of preconceived notions based on research, just things that we've heard and read about. With the Trinity, we had no clue where, and this happened with 1111 too. We had no clue where we were going. In fact, 1111 was suggested to us by our publisher. And we were like, huh? 1111? What the heck is that? So Trinity was the same way. We went into this thinking, you know, we see all these threes. Well, what the heck's going on here? And that, at that point, we took off and started the research. So we didn't have any other notion except there's something going on. And that was a really kind of fun place to come from because it wasn't getting down things that we already believed or thought. It was a whole new discovery for us. We were blown away. I mean, Larry especially, he's much more science-oriented than I am, even though I come from a real scientific background. And this has really opened him up to noetics and metaphysics and, you know, the power of intention and kind of got him hooked on the science behind it as well.
Right. So you're getting all that information and you're looking at these things and all the links mm-hmm. and the coordinates that come together showing this. I mean, with this, and you said it's almost in a sense, it's kind of a self-help book.
Yeah.
How can we use the power of three in our lives to create and manifest? I mean, what, okay, individually, you know, I you've got to become your own Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Is that what you're trying to tell people?
Yeah, I mean, and we've had ancient philosophers pretty much say we are all walking trinities. We have to accept responsibility for our realities, our individual lives. A lot of people don't want to do that. They'd rather blame God, the devil, the Illuminati, the Republicans, the Democrats. You know, I mean, you can add to that list our parents, you know, our teachers. We want to blame everybody else rather than take responsibility for the fact that our thoughts, our intentions, that our minds are incredibly creative and incredibly powerful. What you focus on is what expands in your life. If you want to be a creator and you want a very specific creation, maybe a new job, a new, you know, a spouse, whatever, making more money, you really, really better focus your thoughts, your beliefs, and your intentions toward that goal, or it will not manifest. And this is what we're trying to tell people, that if you are not fully aligned, your subconscious and your conscious mind, with what you want to create out of nothing, or, you know, get something out of nothing, you're going to continue getting what you don't want. You know, if you're going to bitch and moan and complain more than you're going to focus on what you really desire out of life, you're going to get more of what you bitch and moan and complain about. That is the law of attraction at work.
Well, and using that law of threes, you know, to get and to create, I've heard you need want, need, and desire.
Right.
The want to change, the need to have it happen, and the desire. Without all three in effect, nothing will ever come of it.
Exactly.
You'll get a little bit on the road, and that's about the end of it. And the Egyptians and the Aztecs and the Mayans, they knew the power of three with the and we talk about the pyramid power.
Right.
The triangles, the perfect three-sided triangles, things like that, that actually helped to focus energy.
Yeah, the triangle is considered the perfect shape. And it's understanding, too, that if you don't have those three things working in alignment, if one of them is out of whack, and that includes your beliefs. I mean, you can intend or think all the affirmations and positive thoughts you want, but if your belief is, oh, man, this isn't going to happen, you have sabotaged yourself right there. And that's what we're trying to teach people, is that if you don't have all three of these aspects in full alignment, none of them are going to work.
What's the name of the book you were talking about that it's becoming a bigger success than you had imagined?
The Trinity, actually.
Oh, no.
Melly, welcome to the show.
I thought it was something else, though, like something about manifesting.
I just finished a book that'll be out in August called Destiny versus Choice. Oh, get this title. Destiny versus Choice, The Scientific and Spiritual Evidence Behind Fate and Free Will. And a lot of the self-help stuff, let's say, the law of attraction stuff in the Trinity, I got to really expand on. Because thinking about how much of our lives are predestined and how much of it is up to us, the fact that it might be a blend of the two. And, of course, you get into everything that we're talking about here. How much of, you know, are we creating our life as we go along? And if so, how much are we doing that? Are there outside influences that we have to take into consideration? And I do believe there are. But, again, if you look at your life, the vast majority of what is a part of your life, you create it through your choices, through your desires. Now, maybe a lot of it you don't really want, but that's because you were focusing on what you didn't want rather than on what you really did want. And it's that simple.
So, Marie, while yourself and Larry are researching the book, I know you're saying that you can bring negative influence onto yourself, but have you found an instance as you're researching the book where somebody's used the power of three in a negative way or for just downright evil?
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. Hitler. I mean, he understood the rhetoric and the oratory power of using the power of three. Absolutely. You know, you can create whatever you want. So if you're choosing to create terrorism, that same Trinity process is going to work for you. The law of attraction is neutral. It'll go for you positive. It'll go for you negative. It's one of the reasons why I shun religion, because I don't believe that God is a good thing or a bad thing. I believe that that force is totally neutral. We're the ones that decide how to shape it and what we're going to manifest from it. And that explains all of the evils in the world. You know, I don't like to blame things on demons from another realm. I can look at all of the crap in the world and see how it has been created out of people's negative beliefs, thoughts, intentions, and actions. So, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, our guest this evening is Marie D. Jones, co-author with Larry Flaxman of a brand new book, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. How many books have you two teamed up on now?
Trinity is our fourth, and we just signed the contract to do a book called Time Voyagers, The Past, Present, and Future of Time Travel, and that'll be out at the beginning of 2012.
Well, excellent. You're going to have to come back with all the new books, Marie. We love having you on the show.
Absolutely.
What's yours and Larry's website? People can find you again?
Paraexplorers.com, P-A-R-A, paraexplorers.com.
All right. Fantastic. Marie, thank you so much for coming on and joining us and spending your evening here with us.
Thanks, guys. It's always a blast.
All right. Thank you. And I want to thank you all for tuning in and being a part of our evening. For Mally Fox, I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with Tim Donis. We are the powerful Trinity right here. Make sure to join us again tomorrow night. This is Darkness Radio.
The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three. As a man.
Beyond the darkness.
Welcome back to the show. We had an interesting first half with Marie D. Jones talking about the Trinity Theory and the Code of Creation. This half of the show, we're going to talk with Peter Robbins. He's the foremost expert on Rendlesham Forest. And of course, Dave was out there in England this past week and got to see Rendlesham Forest firsthand and survive the experience. Spoiler alert. There you go. So, you know, for his plane ride home, I'd figure I'd freak him out, play a show about Rendlesham Forest so he could quake in his seat on the way home. I mean that way. So let's go to the interview now. Here's Peter Robbins talking about Rendlesham Forest on Beyond the Darkness.
You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. This evening, we are going to be delving into more of the strange and supernatural. We've got a great guest coming our way. Thanks to our good friend, Jeff Belanger from ghostvillage.com. He recommended that we speak to this gentleman. He said, Dave, you want a good UFO story? Then this is the guy you want to talk to. Our guest this evening, Peter Robbins, is one of the best known and most respected investigative writers with regards to the serious study of UFOs. He's been involved in this field for more than 30 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. Peter is a native New Yorker who currently makes his home in Ithaca, New York. We're going to talk about his book, Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation, which he co-wrote with Larry Warren, is published by Cosimo Books, NYC, and can be ordered from any of the online book sources or directly from the author. Tonight, we're going to discuss the United Kingdom's 1980 Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. And this is the first time that we've discussed this case. Of course, we've beaten ad nauseum the Roswell incident into the ground, Peter, and I'm so thankful I've got somebody on that can talk a little bit different. And it's certainly not beating up on Roswell. I know you've got a great event that you're a part of that we're going to talk about on the show this evening as well. But this is something so intriguing to me that I still feel like I'm a new kid on the block. After 5 years, there's all these cases that come to me that are like, Dave, well, you've heard, of course, of Rendlesham. And no, what's going on? Well, you've got to talk to Peter Robbins. This is one of the most well-documented and most amazing UFO landing and cases ever found. And I wanted to have you on the show, share you. I figured if I hadn't heard of all this yet, that there's a lot of my listeners who may have only heard bits and fragments, and we need to get the whole story fleshed out. So it's a pleasure to have you here with us this evening.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Now, let's start getting involved in this. And first of all, Rendlesham Forest is located in the UK.
Yes, it's in Suffolk, England, which is about 80 miles as the crow flies northeast of London.
Okay, and this did take place in the year of 1980, correct?
Uh-huh, in late December, between Christmas and New Year's.
Really? Okay. So it was a good time of year there, coming down for some of the holiday nog. And maybe Now, again, this is, I don't understand how this story has eluded me for as long as it is, so I apologize for my ignorance on this.
Oh, no, that's okay. I think we Americans suffer from a particular form of xenophobia. In other words, if it didn't happen here, how important can it be? there's no question in my mind, and many of the best people in the field here and abroad, and I don't just mean in the United Kingdom, that this is indeed a seminal case, and one of the things that obsessed me with it for the 9 years that my co-author and I worked on and developed our book, and I should say here, Larry Warren, who I wrote the book with, was an American Air Force security police officer at the time who was stationed at RAF Bentwaters at the time of the events, had a secret clearance, was involved as an eyewitness on the final and, I expect, most dramatic or profound of the events that make up the incident, and then went on several years later to become the whistleblower. Without him, this case would have never emerged. But, you know, let's face it, ufology is filled with all kinds of well-documented as well as specious incidents, and you know, how much time do we have to sort through these things? Most people are, you know, trying to make a living and, you know, just live their lives. But it is a terribly important case, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to share some information about it. As I mentioned, Larry and I spent 9 years, and I mean to the exclusion of literally everything else in our lives, returning to England as finances would allow to visit the locations, to win the trust of civilian and military witnesses, and to ultimately publish what still remains the only book on the subject available or written in this country.
Well, and that's just amazing to me, especially that it's got this much documentation behind it and this many eyewitnesses that are willing to come forward.
Yes.
You know, why are we always beaten with the Roswell story? Like you said, it's like if it happens outside of our country, not as important. Now there's the Canadian UFO, Roswell, they consider, you know, that took place. There's other sightings in places that we've talked about. But I want to get into the depth. Was this a nighttime landing? Was it in the daylight? What can you do to set the story going for us?
Well, it was actually a series of events. And I should say here, because we do have the luxury of a little time, to kind of set the scene, there are two very compelling backstories that have nothing to do with the UFO incidents themselves, but are very much worth noting because they do strike a certain chord. Number one, by virtue of our treaty with the United Kingdom in 1980, we were disallowed from maintaining nuclear ordnance at our military bases. I believe that's somewhat different now, but in fact, not only was this huge twin NATO base, it's RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, Bentwaters now decommissioned and being developed privately for civilian purposes, that are only about 6 miles apart from each other, but at the weapons storage area, and that's a euphemism for nuclear weapons storage area, we had something like 350,000 kilotons of nuclear ordnance, much of it tactical, meant for field deployment. I don't have a military background, but you can bet in the 30 years I've worked in this field, in part specializing in military and intelligence awareness and involvement in such incidents, and in the 9 years that I focused in on this Air Force event, I had quite a crash course. A 1 kiloton tactical nuclear device has a 10-mile kill radius. In other words, it would look like a 10-mile circle with that middle mile, the bullseye, being glass, and everything in the radiating 9 miles dead or dying. We had 350,000 approximate kilotons of devices. And this was, again, in full violation of our treaty at the time with the United Kingdom. So that was cause for a certain amount of anxiety when these incursions happened. The other thing is, if you or any of your listeners, even just for fun, were to go to a major newspaper in your state or in the country, and look to the major international news story in that last week of December, it revolved around a pro-democracy movement, so to say, in Poland that was radiating out of a shipyard in Gdansk and headed up by a then-unknown electrician named Lech Walesa. The Soviets were very concerned that this might spread to the rest of Poland, and put them in a spot where they would feel compelled to crush it, much as they did in 1956 in Hungary. What we the people were not aware of, and I'm imagining our news agencies either, was that during that week, literally all fighter aircraft in NATO bases in the United Kingdom and across Europe were already at forward operating locations in West Germany, ready to be deployed should the Soviets roll across the Polish border. We were essentially ready to go to war with the Soviets. So these two events create a very tense background under which these other events I'm about to describe unfold.
Okay.
Even the best folks in the work, and I guess I'm about as well informed as any civilian in this country, and we are still not absolutely positive whether the events transpired over 2 or 3 separate nights. Some of them may have collapsed into the one night on the second night, but the first night, a number of Air Force security police at the east gate of RAF Woodbridge observed a light going down in the woods. And these were essentially the equivalent of regular cops. Larry was a member of the security cops. They were more a paramilitary detachment. And although it did not seem like a crash, there was no fire, there was no ground impact, there was no explosion, a light going down in the woods very close to two highly secured NATO bases must be investigated. And I'm trying to remember now whether it was 4 or 5 of the cops went out there, got permission, drove as far as they could, and then began to walk into the woods. They had flashlights. One of them, as I understand, had a sidearm. They had Motorola radios. And very quickly, the electrics started to be problematic. In fact, they were out of contact with the base for quite some time. And I should also state here that a number of the men, two of whom in particular, John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, who were involved and who have now fully come forward and are speaking fairly openly about their memories as they are, have incomplete memories. The static electricity charge, very powerful as they continued into the area. And then they came upon the thing. The thing was a machine under intelligent control. It was triangular. It was coasting, nice as you please, no particular hurry, through the woods. It was about 7 feet or so on each side and tapered up. And it looked to the surface almost had the appearance of black glass. They got very close to it. Jim Peniston was the first to notice markings on it. I can't call them letters or numbers, but, you know, some kind of hieroglyph, and took out his notebook and began to write what he could to get an impression in his notebook of what he was seeing. Did a drawing, The thing moved through the woods. They got very close to it. Jim touched it. It was warm to the touch, immediately withdrew. John Burroughs, who has been even more public about this and has done quite a number of lectures, he's working very closely in developing this material with Linda Moulton Howe, a very distinguished and well-known UFO investigator. And their talks, I've seen several of them, have been extremely emotional. John is still wrestling with something that is terrifying him, that he, even in regressive hypnosis, refuses, so to say, to go through that final door to face this thing that has created quiet havoc in his life for 29 years now. But at a certain point, they took off and returned to the base, somewhat equivocal about whether or not to report it. In the meantime, unknowns, lights seemingly under intelligent control, were coming in over the bases. They were beaming down what we would now describe as something like industrial lasers. And let's remember, this is England. It's early winter. The air is extremely moist. It was a temperate night, so that those beams of light were catching, you know, billions of little bits of moisture in the air, and you could literally see these lines drawn down to the ground. At one point, lights were beamed into the nuclear weapons storage area. And a rumor, a myth, a legend followed this story once it broke that somehow these lights had affected the ordnance stored in the underground hangars, and that is under layers of earth, steel, and concrete. I was actually taken totally aback when Larry and I, years later and years ago, in 92, as I recall, met with the then recently retired deputy base commander, a man named Charles Halt, who at the time of the incident was a lieutenant colonel, and who, when he heard about the events, took a very sarcastic point of view on them, went out into the woods on the second night when he heard that they had returned to disprove them, and himself and his contingent of men were caught in something like the Twilight Zone. And, you know, I should say here, Dave, when you aspire to write scrupulous nonfiction, even if it's about something as compelling as this subject, you know, things can get boring. So you look for the drama in the real stories. And when I finally spoke with Mr. Halt and we agreed to meet, he selected the location, which was a shopping mall food court. The mall is called Pentagon City, and appropriately it is right across the street from the Pentagon, and that is where we met him and did an hour and 20-minute interview, which was recorded, and the full transcript is in our book. It's a big book. It's 540 pages or so. And at one point he told us that he couldn't explain it, but his quote was that the lights indeed were real, that had shined into the weapons storage area, had shined down somehow through into the area where the weapons were held, and again the quote was, they had adversely affected the ordnance. Now, that's chilling to me, and high drama of the first order. Obviously, right. In saying they adversely affected the ordnance, it didn't affect them in the worst possible manner, because we would only have a bottom part of the United Kingdom, a top right. part of the United Kingdom, and lots of mutants running around in the southern area. But somehow it disabled the weaponry. The next night, a number of things happened. Some of these objects, I will call them craft, came down into the wooded area, the Rendlesham Forest that separates the bases. And this was not mythological or conjecture. Where they came through the forest canopy, they tore out areas of branches. They scraped bark. They left impressions in the soil, equilateral triangles with a circle in each corner.
So much for being stealthy, huh?
Pretty much. And these pressure points, I will conjecture, you know, the impressions of landing gear. When they did pressure tests, they established that whatever had sat on that triangular apparatus had probably weighed several tons. the areas where the machines had made contact with the organic material, be it trees, branches, soil, bark, whatever, had in excess of 10 times the amount of background beta and gamma radiation that one would expect to be occurring naturally. And that figure was confirmed through the British Ministry of Defense. Other of these lights were seen moving through the sky around these bases at points almost like a grid pattern, like aircraft in a search or something. Again, Colonel Halt and his men were in one part of the forest near a farmer's field called Capel Green, and they saw a thing come in toward them that almost looked like an eye, a large winking eye, and that shot a beam of light right down to their feet. And Mr. Hall had a microcassette recorder in his pocket, and by his admission, recorded several hours of their conversations and reactions to what was going on. 15 or 16 minutes was released, basically made its way into the public realm. And if you Google Halt tape, and it's spelled H-A-L-T, I'm sure that you can find it and listen to it on your own. It's certainly been played in many media venues and at conferences and things. The event that my co-author was involved in was really the last documented event of the incidents. And on that night, the tension was so high about the possibility of the state with the Soviets that RAF Bentwaters and Woodbridge were on red alerts, as I understand were other NATO bases in the UK and England. Red is one step below black, and black is war. More often than not, on guard duty, only a portion of the outposts were maintained. On this night, all of them were. And Larry was at the most remote one. He had come back from a few days off, and people were hardly talking about this. It was something that they had been told to be quiet about, and they were, to a great degree. And so he was caught off guard when, after midnight, he went on post, I believe, at 11. He started to hear chatter on the open channel on his Motorola of guys several miles down the line making nervous jokes about the lights in the sky. He could not see them from where he was, but he did hear a more senior personnel come on to that frequency and tell them to knock it off. He was then contacted, told to close down his post, that he'd be picked up for another assignment. And soon thereafter, a pickup truck driven by a lieutenant picked him up. They went to the base motor pool where other vehicles were meeting. Many of the vehicles attached lightalls to them and gassed them up. Lightalls are essentially gas-operated Klieg lights, the military equivalent of the civilian floodlights we associate with old-fashioned Hollywood premieres.
Sure.
They met up at the base's main entrance and headed off into the night, in minor violation now of our treaty with UK, because they were carrying weapons with live ammunition in them, which is a violation. And they were driven about 6 miles to a logging road nearer to their sister base. They made a left after the east gate of Woodbridge, hence the conjugation of the title of our book. Went in some 100 yards or so, were ordered to exit the vehicles. An armorer's truck pulled up, and weapons were collected. Men were broken into three-man groups, each with a Motorola, and sent that away into the woods to, quote-unquote, investigate a disturbance. And for them, this is where the real Twilight Zone aspect of the story began. They also walked into a very noticeable static electricity field, so much so, for me, between the lines and the small details in the telling of these accounts, and I've done so many interviews with so many people over the years, are often the things that you remember more than the big dramatic thing.
Sure.
In this case, Dave, it was that these are young guys, you know, 18, 20-year-olds. And the security police did not wear helmets. They wore berets. Now, remember back to when we had amazingly healthy heads of hair? And
no, Larry, I don't remember that.
Yeah, and Larry said at this point when he first told me the story, he said, you remember Jiffy Pop when you were a kid? Now, that dates us.
Right.
But Jiffy Pop was something in the ancient age before microwaves. It was a tin pan with grease and popping corn in it with a aluminum foil cover that, as it popped, got rounder and opened up. Basically, the static electricity was so intense that it was pushing the berets off the heads of some of these men.
Wow.
They continued into the woods. Larry remembered very clearly hearing a man crying, and as they got closer, one of the personnel was broken down, kind of up against, had his back up against a tree trunk in a sitting fetal position, trying to be calmed and made to feel easier by another personnel. And as they got closer to the edge of the woods, where it opened into this farmer's field called Capel Green, they could see a glow emanating from the field. It was completely anomalous. They're now a mile or so from RAF Woodbridge and 6 miles from their base. There is no moon. There's no ambient light. Light alls are brought out to the field. They refuse to operate, even though they all turned over shortly before at the base motor pool. Gas tanks were all topped off. And they were ordered to surround a self-illuminated ground fog that was roundish or oval, a foot or so off the ground and glowing with no source of light. And several dozen security personnel went into a wide circle around it. They stood their positions for some time, and at one point it was noticed that a small red light was coming in from the direction of the North Sea. We're only about half a dozen miles from there at this point on the coast. And they observed with increasing concern, I imagine, that it was not only coming in over their area, it was coming in directly over the field. All eyes, as you can imagine, were on it. And as it came in to 40 feet or so up, without a sound, it exploded with such magnesium brightness that eyes were averted reflexively. In fact, my co-authors, the retinas of my co-authors' eyes were burned at that moment. That is also not conjecture. We present the Air Force medical evidence in our book.
Good evening and welcome back to the show. This is Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, your home for the best in all things paranormal. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me this evening, we are speaking with Peter Robbins, one of the best known and most respected investigative writers with regards to the serious study of UFOs. His book, Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation, was co-written by Larry Warren, is available at all online book sources. And just hearing what we've heard so far, folks, if you haven't already ordered your copy, I don't know what's going to take you to get there. Do I have to call you? Do I have to walk you over to the bookstore myself? Pick up and check it out online. You're going to want to get this again. Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. And tonight we're discussing this 1980 UFO case with our guest, Peter Robbins. Peter, this is gripping stuff. And when you're hearing the story, do you have any BS detector going off? Are you thinking this is just too fantastical to be true?
Well, I had to. I think the best people in the field are the best skeptics, especially if you've worked in it for years and you've established through dint of hard work, serious investigation. And one of my mentors was a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who also happened to be a UFO investigator, and he taught me to investigate such things the way law enforcement personnel look into criminal activity and felonies. And my reputation was going to rise or fall on whether or not this book could be properly vetted, the material we were putting together. It's one of the reasons we took 9 years to write it. So, yeah, my meter was on, and I interviewed and re-interviewed and re-re-interviewed Larry over the years to the point of distraction for the poor guy, as well as many other civilian and military witnesses. We also had a military paper trail to follow, civilian witnesses, physical evidences. It's almost a perfect storm of a case, as any reader will agree. But where we left off, particularly dramatic moment, this light had come in over the field where these security police personnel had been ordered to surround this self-illuminated ground fog. And again, as it came in over the field,
it now, when you talk to these people, I mean, you tell me after all this is going on, okay, now we want you to start to surround this self-illuminated ground fog. Mm-hmm. At that point, I'm like, you know what? I think I left my flashlight in the car. I'll be right back.
Yeah, the variable there for those of us without military backgrounds is the military and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You are under orders in a very serious situation. You don't have a choice or an option on whether or not to follow the orders you're given. One of the most disturbing aspects of this, in fact, for me was my sixth sense was telling me, and it was confirmed to a degree by a number of the witnesses I've spoken with over the years, that those giving the orders seemed to have some sense of what might be going on, which is rather, it's completely subjective. It's open to interpretation, but it's enough to flatten the hair on the back of your neck. When the vision was restored, imagine, you know, looking at a wall of 1,000 old-fashioned flash bulbs all going off at once. You're blinded for a number of seconds, and as vision was restored, sitting now in the ground fog was a fully articulated machine of undetermined origin that Larry almost wistfully described in this absolutely hypnotically compelling chapter on the particular night in question, looked both old and new. You could see pipe fittings and bolts and things. The surface of it almost glimmered like mother of pearl, and it played tricks on those present. Larry swore that, you know, if you they were maybe no more than 20 feet away from it. They're not standing 50 yards away. It's right there. And it was more easily seen if you turned away from it and looked at it with extreme peripheral vision. He also said, and boy, this guy is, you know, when he says it, he sticks by it, that when you would move, it would have, you know, your shadow on it would move, but a second or two later. Now,
wow.
Bear in mind, there's no light behind them to create a shadow.
Right.
Now, whatever, you know, extraordinary abilities are being exercised here, either technologically or what have you, there's also an element of human shock that we have to factor in, and there's no scientific equation for how best to do this. But a number of the men ran off, as you or I might have.
Right.
The majority of them held their ground, and what then commenced was a standoff. Larry and the man next to him, Sergeant Adrian Bastinza, were asked to accompany the top sergeant on location, Sergeant Ball, in for a closer look, and got within 5 feet of it, and then backed up like cats that had discovered a sleeping giant dog. Went back to the line, so to say. After a fashion, they observed a glow emanating from the far side of the craft that began to move in a clockwise direction slowly. And at a certain point, they could see it directly. And it was three things within the glow. And the glow began to recede. And I think it's a perfectly understandable momentary, and I mean a second or two, shock reaction that my co-author had at that moment, which was he looked at these shapes as they were becoming more discernible, and his reaction was, what are children doing out here? This is a military situation.
Now, can I ask real quickly, and I know my listeners are already thinking this, if his retinas are burned from this, how is he seeing much of anything at this point?
Well, there are burns and there are burns.
Okay.
We know, based on his Air Force Form 490, that his retinas were burned. He did need glasses after that. He suffered a certain amount of discomfort. Had an exam after that, which again established that there were burns, but they were not, burns. They were, he can see fine, but
okay.
There was damage done.
It was almost like a light sunburn on the eyes, then, is what you're saying.
I guess that's about as good a way to interpret it for my lay mind as I've ever heard. Yeah, that's not a bad way to say it. But there were three distinct figures, humanoid in appearance, and unlike ones I've seen depicted in popular fiction or really any that I've heard in the hundreds of abduction cases, which I've worked on and with, in great part with another mentor, Bud Hopkins, who is really the dean, so to say, the pioneer founder of serious abduction studies. I worked as his assistant for many years and had the privilege to meet many people who I am convinced went through that extraordinary experience. But they were more stocky, 4 feet or under. They seemed to each have a one-piece form-fitting type garment, somewhat translucent, and just to cap it off, floating about a foot off the ground.
Hmm.
They, one of my favorite vintage science fiction films, and I think it's one of the finest of its kind, is the early 1950s film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, not to be confused with the more recent remake. And there is that moment.
That was very kind of you.
Yes. Yes, I'm a film maniac, too, and I don't get me off on a tangent there. Yes, Keanu Reeves, wonderfully cast as an alien. The fact that the men were disarmed before they were sent in there, I think, was either just a standard move. Again, they weren't supposed to be armed off the base, but had they been armed, God only knows what might have transpired right then and there. The standoff continued, but now there were these three beings as well as the machine. Now, remember again, this is all occurring in a few nights between Christmas and New Year's, and there was a round of parties going on in this period, and the base wing commander, Gordon Williams, who enters into this story very deeply at this point, had been notified. And I should say right here, Mr. Williams, he's retired now. I couldn't get close to him, but a dear colleague in England, now deceased sadly, Georgina Bruni, was able to sit down and speak with him in working on her book, You Can't Tell the People. And when she asked him point blank if what Peter and Larry maintained and left at Eastgate was true, that he was out in the field that night, he gave her something like a Mona Lisa smile and said, I will neither confirm nor deny my involvement. So it's worth noting. Anyway.
Definitely. Peter, we have to take another quick break here. It's
yep.
going by fast on us. Peter Robbins is our guest this evening. Peter, is there a website or any information people can go look you up and find more info on this?
I will have a website up and running soon. Right now they can Google my name and the three magic letters UFO. A lot of stuff will come up.
Great.
Or they can write me.
All right. And the email address to write you?
Yeah, it's my first initial last name, PROBBINSNY @yahoo.com.
All right, we'll be back with more. Peter Robbins, author of Left at the East Gate, a firsthand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. When we return, you're listening to Darkness Radio. Good evening and welcome back to the show. This is Darkness Radio, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio. Our guest this evening I want to jump back in with is Peter Robbins. He's written a book called Left at East Gate, a firsthand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation, co-written with Larry Warren. We've got only about 10 minutes left with you, Peter. This story is so compelling. I want to know more. We'll talk tonight and finish this up, but will you come back with us again in the future and take more questions from our listeners and allow us to be a part of that world as well?
Only if you ask me.
Yeah, you know what's going to be done. All right, let's hear some more of the story and find out what all happened with this.
Yeah. Well, Wing Commander Williams was coming from a holiday party and walked out into that field in evening clothes. Stepped through the cordon of men, a particularly tall man, looked down from about 15 feet away at these beings who all cocked their head ever so slightly to look at him in the same moment, and the face-off continued very peacefully until the wee hours of the morning. Larry was in the second-to-last contingent, taken off the line and brought back to base and told not to talk about this. We understand, but I can't confirm, that before dawn, the craft, the beings disappeared into the craft, we can assume. It rose off the ground, tipped slightly, and took off, and in a moment was no bigger than a star. Back on the base, men were very shaken in their quiet way. Larry, like all the other men, had been told not to talk about this to each other, to anyone. But being Larry, called his mother that morning from a base phone, started to tell her about it, was cut off, was punished for that, and was debriefed with men of his rank later in the day. They were shown footage purporting to be UFOs in military situations over the years and ending with some lunar surface footage. My very truest feeling is that it was first-class disinformation, namely a very skillful skillful mixture of fact and fiction to produce a specific result, in this case, to frighten these men enough that they would never talk about this, and if they did, they'd sound like raving lunatics. But the story continued, and he was told to be outside of his dormitory, his residence, that night about 8, to have another debriefing. We know as well as we can, and he relived this while I sat very close by in regressive hypnosis years later, that he was chemically subdued, thrown in a car, went well underground to a very highly secured, huge underground complex under this twin base area, and was missing for 24 hours or so. And during this time was subjected to a certain number of things to create impressions that he was in the presence of non-human beings as well as human beings. I do not know, nor does he, I think, for sure, what the absolute story was. He became obsessed with the case, violated orders, and tried to find out more about it, appropriately became concerned about his safety, was taken off of his normal posting occasionally, and you were allowed at that point to sue for separation if the service branch did not fulfill their agreement with you. And in this case, he left the service with an honorable discharge in May of 1981, tried to readjust to civilian life, very difficult for him, and a year or so later decided to try to find somebody to tell his story to, ended up telling an awful lot of it to an outstanding investigator who happened to be a Connecticut police lieutenant. And with the information that Larry gave them and working with a nonprofit called Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, put together a Freedom of Information Act action that resulted in the release of a one-page report by Colonel Halt on the event.
Wow, a whole one-page report?
Yes. It was highly compressed and redacted to a degree. Mr. Halt's the first to admit that. The release of that report did not help Mr. Halt's career, to put it mildly, and I think there was some animus for years that he had been outed along with many of the other men. But the story broke in the English tabloids and then the major papers in October of 1983 and has been a publicly acknowledged incident since. I should also say that the Ministry of Defense since then has declassified a good number of documents that relate to this. No smoking guns, but a lot of interesting smoke, as you might imagine. But it is, for my money, about the most important case we have. All of the witnesses, with a few exceptions, are alive. They're subpoenable. If our Congress had the guts to reinvestigate this question of UFOs, it could be the one to blow the top off of it. And as we head deeper into the year, you and your listeners should be aware that this December is the 30th anniversary of the Rendlesham Forest incident. And I can tell you where I'm going to be in late December, sitting in the forest in Suffolk with a number of the guys that were involved, trying to keep warm and just marking this occasion. It hurt many men's lives. I documented 2 suicides. Many of the men who have come forward as witnesses are still under the influence of post-traumatic stress, and their lives have never been the same. It's about the most important case we have.
It's unbelievable. Just unbelievable.
Yes. Well, yes, it is. And that's a very good way to say it, but even if something is unbelievable, does not mean it didn't happen. We include a great deal of military paperwork, physical evidence that in itself is extraordinary. Very briefly, that spot where this thing happened, again, December 1980, we revisited it for the first time, and I've been back there now more times than I can count, in February of 1988, and the spot was discolored, and the soil was different than in the surrounding areas. It was professionally analyzed in late 1990, almost 10 years after the events, and our soil analyst told us some very interesting things that we publish. Number one, that in seed germination tests between affected samples and control samples, it always takes longer for organic material to mature in the affected sample, and there are always mutant variations of the plants. It has more than four times the amount of macroscopic metallic particles in the soil, which we could only deduce suggested a powerful electromagnetic force, extremely powerful, that drew these into the area. And the sand content in the soil, and again, you'd expect some because we're 6 miles from the sea,
right,
was not sand anymore, Dave. It was, in the dispassionate term of our analyst, it was in an interim form of glass, and that's one of the physical evidences that we present for our audience.
Unbelievable. That is just, I mean, what a story. And people pick up the book. Again, this is out there, and it's available everywhere through major booksellers. Again, the name of the book is Left at Eastgate, A First-Hand Account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO Incident, Its Cover-Up and Investigation by Larry Warren and Peter Robbins.
Thanks. I should say, unfortunately, it's not available through major booksellers, but again, Amazon, all of the online booksellers have it. Or
I think that's pretty much your major booksellers nowadays.
You're right. Hey, well said. You can, again, order it directly from Cosmo Press, or you can contact me, and I'll arrange to get a copy out to you.
All right, and if people want to contact you again, it's P. Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S.
Mm-hmm. And then NY for my home state, .com. P. Robbins, NY, P. Robbins, NY at yahoo.com.
probbinsny@yahoo.com, and you can order an autographed copy directly through you.
Absolutely.
Peter, this has been enlightening, and like I said, I'd love to have you come back on the show. We certainly want to talk to you after you go out there for the 30th anniversary and let us know what's happened. Has just real quickly, with 2 minutes left in the show, has there been any more sightings in and around that area again?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Are they coming on a regular basis?
Or no, no, but there are higher incidence of sightings than surrounding areas in the United Kingdom for reasons we can just make our best guesses about.
Now, can you tell me, or do you allude to it more in the book, when you say that it had an adverse reaction to the weapons and things that were on hand? By that, did it knock them, render them useless? Did it?
Well, that again is conjecture. Even Mr. Hall was not able to give us details. And he shouldn't. If he knows, that's really not our business on a certain level. I wish it was. But the fact that he actually confirmed that, and when I have brought that up, he has never denied it, although he's never said anything about it in public, and that's more than understandable.
Interesting, considering so many UFO sightings happen around nuclear power plants,
yes,
nuclear weapons factories, nuclear machines, or not machines, but ships, things that are carrying nuclear weapons. It's like, I know the Reagan is one of the most followed ships, and they've got quite a bit of nuclear work going on there. So
doubly ironic, as President Reagan, when he was governor of California, had a honking major UFO incident from the governor's plane, extraordinary sighting that was confirmed by him and the pilot. He knew they were real, no question about that.
Well, Peter, thank you very much, sir. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we'll look forward to talking to you again on the show real soon.
My pleasure as well, Dave. Give me a call, and we'll arrange for the next show.
Will do, and thank you guys. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.
Well, folks, that'll wrap it up for another edition of Beyond the Darkness. Thanks to Marie D. Jones and for Peter Robbins for joining us yet again on Beyond the Darkness. albeit in repeat form, but we appreciate it. Hope you had a good week, and hope you enjoyed revisiting some of the older shows with me. Next week, all new shows. We have brand new Supernatural News and Parashare next week, and also a great slate of guests. We'll be talking to Barry Strom next week. Bruce Gernon will join us, and much, much more. We've got some great shows ahead for the next week as well. So make sure that you keep it tuned right here. And make sure that you also have the new Podcast One app. I can't stress this enough. The new Podcast One app allows you to do different things, including join the Beyond the Darkness community. The Beyond the Darkness community is brand new to the app. You just got to check it out for yourself. Again, it's available for Android and for iOS formats. The Podcast One app is truly something you want to check out. And not only do you get Beyond the Darkness with that, you get plenty of other free podcasts out there as well. The entire Jericho Network family is on there. Raven's podcast is there. Conan's podcast is there. Talk is Jericho. Tiger Team Awesome is there. Rock Talk is there as well. So be sure to check it out. The Podcast One app is available in the Google Play Store or at the App Store in your Apple device as well. That'll do it. We'll see you next week. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Darkness.
This is Julian Edelman from Dudes on Dudes with Gronk and Jules. Sunday mornings, I've got my game day ritual. Coffee, lucky socks, and now new morning Uncrustable sandwiches.
It's all about that 12-gram protein boost with the new Uncrustables Bright-Eyed Berry or Up and Apple flavors.
Bright-Eyed Berry's got a feisty receiver energy.
Up and Apple, your classic do-it-all tight end.
Soft, pillowy, packed with protein, and easy enough for Gronk to grab from the freezer.
Whether you're on the couch, driving to the tailgate, or heading to the locker room, new morning Uncrustable sandwiches are the MVP of snacks.
Your new Sunday kickoff ritual starts here with new morning Uncrustable sandwiches packed with 12 grams of protein.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at CVS.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.